Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this June the 17th on the West Coast, now June the 18th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and want to mention something that I'm sure many of you are probably familiar with. If you were listening to a Marines Disquisition with Drew Malone Raines III today, he was talking about a suspect. It's interesting, they use the word suspect, with ties to Al-Qaeda, and I think the Taliban as well, in the U.S. Marine Corps, in the vicinity of Arlington National Cemetery. I understand he was planning on blowing up the U.S. Marine Corps monument. And this is a serious matter if it's happening like it's been described to have happened. Yet we've learned from past false flag events that these things are done just to create a lot of fear and measure or gauge the general public's response. This one, I think, is for the military to see where you guys and gals are thinking and what your concerns are. I'm still waiting for some kind of an update. The last update I had was time-stamped at 12:18 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Would it surprise you the amount of chaos going on in the world? These people stop at nothing, absolutely nothing, to just wreak havoc across the planet. And but we're going to talk about more important things, things that are really issues pressing humanity at this time in our history. And we're going to honor some of the higher technologies this evening with our guest. Before we bring him on, however, I would like to dedicate a song to the folks with Project Alliance. I want you to know that we are praying for you, and I dedicate this to the whole group and to Jelaya. And the message here is, don't give up.
Wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name, but no one wants you. When you lose,
don't give up. You still have friends. Don't give up. You're not beaten yet. Don't give up. I know you can make it good.
Saw it all about. Never thought that I could be affected. Thought that we'd be last to go.
It is so strange the way things turn. Draw my night toward my home, the place that I was born, on the lakeside. As daylight broke, I saw the earth, the trees had burned down to the ground.
Don't give up, you still have us. Don't give up, we don't need much of anything. Don't give up, 'cause somewhere there's a place where we belong. Rest your head, you worry too much. It's gonna be alright when time.
Gonna stand on that bridge, keep my eyes down below. Whatever may come, I'm wherever they go. That river's flowing, that river's flowing. Moved on to another town, tried hard to settle down. For every job, so many men, so many men no one needs.
Don't give up, you still have us. Don't give up, you're not the only. Don't give up, no reason to be ashamed. Don't give up, you still have us. Don't give up, we're proud of who you are. Don't give up, you know it's never been easy. Don't give up, 'cause I believe there's a place where we belong.
Well, that's Peter Gabriel, and he's joined by Miss Paula Cole on Don't Give Up. While I was listening to that, I was thinking of the expansiveness of space and the realization that this show is heard on over 2,000 planets in our galaxy struck me for a moment. I seem to forget that from night to night. And the ethereal nature of that song and knowing the strifes that others endure for the purpose of helping us here on this planet, just the thought of it overwhelms me. We need to be praying for those out there that, whether you want to believe this or not, is a different issue. I'm not asking you to believe it. It's better you know it. We have life teeming throughout this galaxy and throughout the universe, for that matter. We're going to be talking about energies. Energies used for transportation throughout the galaxy and throughout the universe. These are universal principles known to intelligent beings who are with us, despite the lies that we are told. I've spent the past week making great discoveries on planet Earth. And when I consider the amount of obfuscation that's there, the masking of images on the ocean floors, we are a pitiful lot if we allow the powers that be to continue lying to us and dumbing us down. And so I wanted to dedicate that song to the folks from Project Alliance and Jalaya, and also those listening on many, many other locales in the galaxy. Think about that. That message is not just for us or just for one person. It's for all of God's creation, really. Don't give up. Well, here we are, another end of the week, Friday night, and I am regularly joined by my co-host, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show. Have I lost you, Jim? Seth, if you can look into that and see why we're not hearing. Okay, Seth is checking. Well, it seems always to happen when I make his introduction. For the past couple of months now, this has been going on. If you were listening to the show last night, we had a burst of AM and FM radio come through the show. It was not our fault. We don't know the source, but we can assume it's that people that work with the NSA don't know what their pay grade is, but they had to interfere with some truth that was coming out on last night's show with Christopher Holmes, and it never ceases to amaze me that these things come up, and we weren't really even touching on any great secrets being kept from the planet, just talking about the nature of those that control this planet. It sounds like, or it looks like, we have Jim Murray back with us. Jim, are you with us?
Yeah, I am, and I'm totally mystified. I don't know what the heck happened this time, but in the middle of the song, all of a sudden everything went dead, and I couldn't clear my line. It was really strange. Usually when I hang up, I try calling the station, or at least I leave the line open, you know, for them to call me, and I couldn't hang up. I pushed the button several times, and I couldn't disconnect. I was sitting here wondering what to do, and all of a sudden, the station phoned me, and it went through. So it's very bizarre.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I basically introduced you to our listening audience and told them that we're going to be talking about anti-gravity and antimatter in terms of power production or transportation. Right now, on this planet, most people who are searching for new reliable sources of energy for the purpose of power production are fixated on a term called zero point. And as if starting from nowhere is going to lead you somewhere. But I'll leave it up to you as to where you want to talk. We've been trying to do this for the past few weeks, so finally we're getting around to it.
Well, that's true. There's been delays and everything, but I think that some of the stuff that we covered, you know, instead of this topic were probably worth the time, or else we wouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I would like to believe, anyway.
Yes.
Well, let me address the issue of this zero point thing as a starting place for tonight's discussion, because it's really kind of interesting. And of all people, my dear friend and associate, Nikola Tesla, addressed this issue many, many years ago. Well, of course, most of what he said fell on deaf ears.
Mm-hmm.
But let's picture a water wheel to begin with. Everybody should be familiar with a water wheel. So we have a stream or something which has been diverted over a height, and it's allowed to fall onto the periphery of a wheel that's got buckets or slots or whatever you want to call it. and naturally the wheel rotates, and we now have a source of power as long as we have the water flowing. And, of course, this has been a bone of contention with a lot of people over the years, because the way they like to look at things is, well, you know, it's unfortunate that we're dependent upon that water flowing. Why couldn't you do something with water that wasn't flowing? You know, so like if you had a pond or something on your property, isn't there some way you can avail yourself of the, I don't know what you want to call it, the potential energy, it sounds like a good term, of the water in that pond? Well, of course, potential energy in its own right is very difficult to harness without something changing. And a perfect example of that would be as follows. Let's say we transport our water wheel to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. We set it up down there. Now, nobody's going to argue about the fact that you've got all kinds of water pressure. Let's say you're down, you know, on the bottom of the deepest trench somewhere, and you got 5 miles of water above you. The pressure is going to be ungodly. But the problem is that the pressure is also uniform. And so unlike the stream that impinges upon only a portion of the disc, thereby imparting a torque to the wheel, you now have an infinite amount of water, for all intents and purposes, bearing down on every surface of the wheel with equal intensity. And so therefore, you've got an infinite number of torques in all different directions, which is the same as having no torque, believe it or not. So the wheel's just going to sit there. And the question has always been, isn't there a way to tap into this situation without violating any laws of nature? And like I said, Tesla addressed this issue in a very intriguing article that he wrote called Increasing Human Energy. I don't remember the year in which it was published, but it made quite a sensation at the time. And in that article, of course, he covers a broad spectrum of different concepts in the context of this article. But the thing that grabbed my attention when I read it many, many years ago, as a matter of fact, I found that article in its original form in the main public library on 42nd Street in New York City when I was a teenager. And I have to be honest with you that it really did shape my thinking considerably, which has served me pretty well over the years. And that's one of the reasons why I'm relating the whole issue, because I think it's pretty cool. And here's a guy who authored this manner of, I don't know what the word would be, contemplating these complex issues well over 100 years ago. So I think that they are of very fundamental value, and they should serve to stimulate other people as they did me. Anyway, getting back to the main issue of tapping this potential energy in a body of water that's not moving. And, of course, you have to realize that the water can be any form of energy, including thermal energy, but it's just an analogy that's used to actively describe a very subtle and very interesting mechanism. So let me now expand upon that.
Okay.
Tesla says the following. Suppose we construct a large metal tank, and we take this tank into the middle of a deep lake, and we sink it into a position where the rim of the tank is just a foot or so above the water level of the tank in the area where we sink it. Now we proceed to pump the water out of the tank. Okay, now we are doing work in removing that water, and we are creating, in the process, a potential gradient due to the pressure differential between the outside water and the space created by the tank and the fact that we are removing the water from the tank. So now when we have the tank completely empty, let's assume that there's a valve at the very bottom of the tank, and we allow the valve to be opened, which gives us access to the pressure differential that we just created. Now, if we attach some kind of a device to the inside of that valve, so that the water coming through back into the tank is forced to do some work when it comes in, like perhaps a water turbine, for instance, we will find, if we do the measurements properly, that as the tank refills under the influence of the external pressure, the best we can ever hope for is to produce the same amount of work that we expended in emptying the tank. Mm-hmm. There isn't anybody on the face of the earth who will argue with that. You know, that's pretty cut and dry. You can do the numbers or look it up in any kind of a physics book, and that point of view will be upheld. And that's, of course, one of the pillars of conservation of energy.
Now, you're describing, Jim, you're describing basically a mechanical action, right? Or a mechanical process.
Yeah, it's mechanical, but the thing that's going to be interesting when I finish with this description is the fact that if people buy it and understand it, they'll realize that it pertains or could pertain to any form of energy imaginable.
Yes.
Because it represents a concept and a methodology. It isn't just to be understood completely as a mechanical or a hydraulic concept. It's easier to paint pictures using water flow and stuff like that than it is to talk about ethereal pressures, for instance. But yeah, there's no reason why the same process can't be applied to anything else that you care to apply it to.
Yes. Yeah, I brought that up because, well, my mind is already envisioning something even beyond ethereal and just looking at simple life force, you know. But
and it may very well work there too. But anyway, let me finish the analogy because we're sort of in the middle of it right now.
Okay, go ahead.
So anyway, having played this game with the tank, it's all it's going to teach us is what everybody's already aware of, that the work that you do on a restorative system gives you back whatever you put into it minus the losses. And that's where the story would end, except for the fact that Tesla was brilliant enough to see a loophole, if you want to call it that, in the physics of the situation. So now let's go back to the original description. We've got the tank. We pumped it out already. There's a valve at the bottom of the tank. There's a turbine connected to the valve on the inside of the tank. And the turbine is going to be turning a generator. And the generator is going to be powering a device which electrolyzes the water that's coming in to the bottom of the tank. So now the only change that we're going to make is we're going to put a hood over the tank at this point, and that hood is going to be to collect the electrolyzed gases. Now, I realize this takes a stretch of the imagination to understand all this, but it's not really that bad to follow the logic. So now we open our valve, and the pressure differential causes the water to rush in again. The water turns a turbine. The turbine runs a generator. The generator produces enough electricity, in the theory anyway, to electrolyze the water coming in. So now we change the water into hydrogen and oxygen. Now, the hydrogen and oxygen rise up inside the tank. They get collected in the hood, and we take the fumes through a pipe into a burner where we burn it, and we use the burning hydrogen and oxygen to boil water and run a steam engine, and we measure the work done by the steam engine. Well, now what's happening is very interesting because the the tank never fills up. And the process continues, and the new limitation, which was not the original limitation, changes from being the volume of the tank to being the volume of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So now, theoretically, we drain the entire lake into the tank, and all that we paid for was creating the original gradient of pumping out the tank. Now, a lot of people find this an extraordinary stretch of the imagination to do this, but I'm not suggesting it would work in that particular arrangement. I'm simply reporting the way Tesla described his idea many years ago. The secret that's involved in this particular line of thinking is that you can eliminate the restrictions of a self-destroying gradient if you change energy from one form to another in the process, because entirely different types of energy can manifest in the same space without interfering with one another. But if you leave the energy in the same form, then the dynamics of the system will eventually stop. And that's exactly what we see in every single example where conservation of energy is applied. If we're talking about a thermal system, you have to have a hot reservoir and a cold reservoir, and heat will flow from one to the other until the two equalize in temperature, and then it stops. If you have water falling from a height into something, as the level of the collected water reaches the same level as the supply, the process stops. If you have a battery and you're supplying power to something, in that case you've got two possible variants. One will be that the battery runs out. And the second thing will be that if you're charging a capacitor or something, when the capacitor voltage reaches the battery voltage, the process will stop. So all of those things are what we witness in the normal application of physics under the guise of conservation of energy, and everybody respects those things. But mm-hmm. what they're not considering is what happens if you can change energy from one form to another so that it doesn't get in its own way, and you therefore have a self-perpetuating gradient. You now have a totally different situation to contend with. Mm-hmm. And that's what Tesla did with all of his stuff. And the reason that we started with this is because the current trend, which you identified at the beginning of the program, Don, is to try and tap the so-called zero-point energy, which is, you know, the energy, the background energy, or the energy matrix that perpetuates all of space, that it has a fixed potential, but the potential of it is almost incalculable. It's so huge.
Yes.
And so it represents an infinite reservoir for all intents and purposes. And if it could be tapped effectively by mankind, that would be the equivalent of getting that water wheel to turn at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And so that's what is described by attempting to capture the zero-point energy. And actually, Tesla, I'm sure, actually accomplished that in several of his devices. And mm-hmm. he did it by having an understanding of what's required to make it happen, which is the attainment of a self-perpetuating gradient. Well, I hope that that's a stimulating way to start this show.
Yes. Can I comment a little bit as far as what I'm perceiving from what you said? And this includes some of your more recent lectures on waterfalls, for example, when you were describing how the fish can ride this wave of energy and move against the current of the waterfall and actually go up to the top of the falls. With no effort. It seems to me that we see the water, but that's all we see. We don't see the potential that's in the other forms of energy that exist within the water. If they weren't there, the water wouldn't be moving. The molecules wouldn't move at all. Even in what we would call a stagnant pool of water, whether it's a lake or a pond or a tank, there's still energy flowing, and that energy, as you very rightfully stated, is flowing throughout the universe. It's not sitting still. So are we sort of ignoring the mouse because we see the elephant? That's sort of what I'm intending to say. In other words, that principle could be taken into a more ethereal viewpoint, and we could consider the energy that's basically ignored.
But well, I'm sure that it would be just as valid in the ethereal level, because I believe, and I'm sure you do too, Don, that everything that we perceive with our senses is at a pretty low octave of expression. And there are higher and higher octaves of the same law being applied as you climb the ladder of existence, whatever you want to call it, or the ladder of creation. So what we perceive on the physical plane, there is a counterpart on the ethereal plane, there's a counterpart on the spiritual plane, and I'm sure there's a counterpart on the divine plane. It's just that we don't have the capacity to understand what it's doing in those higher levels of expression.
Mm-hmm.
We're normally concentrating on what it's doing on our level, and some people have a heck of a time understanding that.
Yeah, I'm referring
to... It makes us very humble. It should make us very humble. Mm-hmm. And very conscious of our limitations as human beings.
Yes. I've certainly been in contact with things that seem not to have life force in them. That which is absent of life force is usually called dead, although it still has the capacity to receive life force and change its state into one which would probably represent not just life, but action or intent or even a reaction to other phenomena that are going on. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but let's say, for example, and I explained this to you a couple of weeks ago off the air, you can measure a body of water or a container of water or a geographical area of land or a geographical area of the oceans, and you can determine whether or not it's abundant with life force. And where your eyes can see that life force is missing by certain characteristics. The plants seem to be lifeless. Water doesn't move as rapidly, or maybe not at all, through a stream or a river. The plant life on the banks of the river seem to be suffering when the optimal energies are not flowing freely through that river. In other words, if there's some impedance, something that's preventing it from occurring naturally, then we get death, or we get a lower vibration, we get a lower frequency. Now, let's say that it's just regular water, but it measures through dousing or just through metaphysical sensitivity, we can determine that it's not beneficial. It wouldn't be beneficial to drink it because it doesn't have life force in it. Now, you can take a couple of drops of water with life force in there, and eventually the whole vortex will spin in a direction that indicates that there is now life force in the whole body of water. So there are elements or there are phenomena going on in that body of water when it's in its most optimum state that we're still ignorant of, if you get my meaning. We're looking at the water, but we're not looking at what's in the water. And I don't mean the tank or fish or plants or things like that. The unseen things that are there. Because that those things tie the whole universe together.
Well, I agree with that, by the way. And it's very reminiscent of a classical mental experiment that was proposed. I can't remember the name of the guy just now. But anyway, he was a pretty famous philosopher. And basically he said, well, if you take a whole room full of tuning forks that are all at the same frequency, and you vibrate one only, sympathetic resonance will ensure that they will all wind up vibrating at that frequency. The question is, when all of them are vibrating, do you have more energy or less, or the same amount of energy as we imparted to the first tuning fork? Now, I don't know if anybody's ever done the experiment or not.
Well, I can.
It's an interesting thing to think about.
I can give you an example of that. Let's say I'm tuning a piano and I grab A440 tuning fork and I tap it on my knuckle, or I tap it on the edge of the piano's plate where I can cause it to ring for a few seconds.
Right.
Okay. Now, at the point where that percussive attack takes place, the sound waves, based on the velocity that I strike the plate of the piano with the tuning fork, and how tightly I'm holding it. In other words, if I'm holding it in a consistent manner, which will allow it to always vibrate the same length of time, the amplitude then affects the volume of the sound. Now I can take it and tap it on the plate of the piano and then stand it up on the soundboard of the piano or on the pin block of the piano or even on the piano's cabinet. And the cabinet will amplify the sound. It's not that there's more energy, but it's that it uses the energy in a different way. Okay, it gives it something to pick up the sound. So the sound is not just passing through the air. It's actually going into something that resonates and makes the sound of the tuning fork much louder than it would be if I just allowed it to be suspended in the air. You understand?
I understand completely. So, but it doesn't answer the question yet. Supposing that all the strings in the piano were 440 instead of, you know, the various frequencies that they are, you know, would they all start vibrating? And if they did, would the total amount of vibration be greater than or equal to the initial effort?
Well, the strings won't begin vibrating until I release the felt and the hammers that are actually impeding that vibration. You're talking.
Well, okay, I realize that, but I mean, in the ideal case, if they were all released and free to vibrate, is there any way to determine the answer to that hypothetical question?
Yeah. They would, depending on the intensity, because you have different gauges of wire and different constructs, you have more nickel in some of them. Some have more copper windings, more windings or fewer windings. More density, less density, lower frequency. Even if they're tuned at the same frequency, you're just spreading the same energy out over a wider area. If that's conducive to hearing it without actually striking it with a percussive attack, you should hear all the strings, but it doesn't mean that suddenly you're going to have this loud sound. In that case, what the nature of wood, this is the point I'm trying to make, is the nature of the wood is different from the nature of the strings. And even though the wood is used to maintain tension on the pin blocks and thus tension on the strings from the pin tuning pins to the hitch pins at the other end of the piano and back, you have the ability for that to resonate, but you have to hit the tuning fork very loudly to make a perceptible sound through the strings. Conversely, if I just tap it and touch any of the wood parts of the piano, the wood resonates and amplifies the sound in a different manner than the strings do. So
that's very similar to what Tesla suggested about changing the energy from one form to another in order to avail yourself of some of the untapped potential.
Yes. Or I'm saying, I'm proposing the question, not to go off on a tangent, but just to propose the question that are we looking at the water as an obvious way to produce power through a mechanical means or through Tesla's process? And we should probably be looking to something that could produce much more power that's already in the water.
Well, actually, what you're recommending there, consciously or otherwise, is the Schoberger point of view, because you know that's exactly what he said. He said, "Well, we're so entrenched with the physical properties of the water, like its weight, for instance, its volume, and its chemical composition, and all this stuff, that we're ignoring the fact that as the blood of the planet, which is what water really is, it's also a carrier of higher energies."
Yes.
It's the same thing. It's analogous, actually, to what the Hindus and the Ayurvedic experts in India used to say about the presence of prana in the blood.
Yes.
When we breathe air in, we are taking in air, and we're very familiar with the oxygen content and the expulsion of CO2 and all this kind of stuff. But going in with the air is also the universal life force, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
They refer to as the prana, and that, in fact, permeates the entire body and sustains life as we breathe.
Yes, so I'm in agreement. I was listening. Yeah.
Well, I heard a big beep on my end. I didn't know what that was.
Oh, okay.
So this is the counterpart of that prana situation would be the magnetic dipole charge of the water, or the dielectric charge of the water. I'll be honest with you. I've tried to look into that numerous times over the years. And aside from experiments that I devised on my own, there's nothing anywhere that I could find that openly describes that particular form of potential associated with water. And yet water will do some very strange things on its own accord, as you know.
Yes. Okay, well, I think, you know, you've answered my questions. I'm just proposing that because I think, you know, the whole approach, I'm envisioning this big, huge water wheel rotating on a shaft and seeing the paddles or the buckets scooping up the water. And there has to be some force driving it to, you know, to keep it moving. If the water stops moving, eventually that stops. So we seem to be doing a lot of work to get the power started, and there may be something much, much subtler that actually produces much more power. That's what I'm implying. Difficult.
Well, I realize that, and I think that Tesla was aware of stuff like that too, and so was Keeley, and so are a lot of other people. The place where this is taking us, incidentally, is to a very interesting area, which is quite controversial in view of the accepted wisdom held by classical science.
Okay, I'm all ears.
As you know, E equals MC squared suggests that energy and matter are just different forms of the same thing, and that when we release energy, let's say in a nuclear reaction or something, there will always be a corresponding quantity of mass which disappears when this energy appears. And that has led to the I won't say understanding, let's call it a belief, that that mass and energy are equivalent, and they're in different forms, like steam and ice, for instance. But according to what Tesla accomplished in his studies, he says that actually the entire concept of the interconvertibility of mass and energy is an illusion, and that that no matter has ever given up energy by virtue of its disintegration, even though it looks like it does that, that the energy really comes from the environment. And if you take what he said literally, then what he's implying is that what's being ignored in modern physics is the relationship between mass and the zero-point energy, which already exists everywhere in space, but requires a transformation mechanism of the type that I described with the water tanks in order to make itself or make its presence known.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like putting the water wheel at the bottom of the Atlantic and not getting any results, that's the same thing that you have when you consider the vast amount of energy that's distributed all throughout the known universe. There's no gradient to allow it to express itself, but mass can actually be that gradient because it's occupying a particular volume of space, and perhaps the energy that surrounds it cannot occupy the same space with the same flux density, energy flux density, that it would if the mass wasn't there. And so if we disintegrate something or change its form or break it up, we're now essentially creating a differential that exists for a few microseconds until that energy rushes in to fill the space. And if you can imagine a way in which to utilize that disturbance, that local disturbance, then you suddenly have a mechanism that allows you to convert energy in an intrinsic field into usable work. And, of course, if you can do this repeatedly over and over again at a high enough rate of frequency, then you will essentially be taking energy out of the substructure of the universe. And that's, I believe, what man's ultimate goal should be instead of fighting over oil, for God's sake.
Well, it seems like it would be the most logical and the most natural way to produce power. While you were talking, I was envisioning the qualities of water. Water transmits sound. It transmits light. It's a receiver and a transmitter, actually. So it's a perfect conductor for certain types of energy. Now, suppose that you had light passing through water, and at some point, some of the molecules of the water began to exhibit a charge. I don't know if you would call that a pyroelectric charge or if that would have to actually occur outside of the water. But if you were able to manifest that into a usable system, certainly there now is another means of producing power. It may take a long time, but then again, it may be much more efficient in its operation. And it's, let's say, it's regeneration. We seem to be constantly, like you said, you know, using oil, burning things or exploding things. And that eventually those molecules that are receiving the light and manifesting it in different ways would probably begin producing electromagnetism of some sort. And then you can take that and reverse the poles, and now you're getting into an area of the concept of anti-gravity. just from an electromagnetic viewpoint. I know I sound like I'm outside the box tonight.
No, I don't think so at all. As a matter of fact, even Wilhelm Reich, who was very taken up with the biological energy or the life force energy, whatever you want to call it, he came to the conclusion that there's a coupling between the life force and the gravitational force, and that UFOs were essentially making use of that form of energy. And in order to prove his theory, he shot one down. And I don't know if you know this story or not, but it's pretty interesting. He had this so-called Cloudbuster, which was a contraption on the back of a truck, had these 30-foot pipes that were all grounded together into a giant system of exceptionally large BX cables, and they were put into a stream or running water, and then this other device was aimed at the sky, and it could produce a charge that was violent enough to knock him completely off the truck if he touched the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he parked this thing out in the desert near some stream or some waterway somewhere until he saw a UFO, and then he directed this Cloudbuster at the UFO, and it literally dropped, right out of the sky. The vehicle recovered because in dropping so fast, it got out of the way of the beam mm-hmm. of this thing. But that was proof enough to him that the anti-gravity that they were using was connected somehow with the life force that he was experimenting with, and also with the Earth's intrinsic vortex.
Yes.
And so it's very possible that beings from another world have long since solved these problems and understand things from a much wider perspective than we do, and have actually already coupled into the life force and understand the relationship between the vehicles that they construct, the force of gravity, which keeps them upon a given planet, and the dynamic capabilities of the life force, which allows them to maneuver in that medium, just like an airplane maneuvers in the air. A UFO, let's call it what it really is, a flying saucer, is not an aerodynamic vehicle. It may be moving through the air, but what it's actually moving in is this invisible form of energy that Reich referred to as the orgone, and that's exactly what the fish is doing in the situation that you cited earlier, where he's immersed in water, but he's using a secondary force to propel himself or to maintain a position against the torrent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to me that these secrets of nature are not hidden. They're right out in the open. But it's our lack of attention and consciousness which prevents us from seeing the true mechanisms.
Yes, I agree. Well, I hope you don't mind my dwelling on that, because it kept hitting me, over the back of my head, like, duh, why are we doing this with the water? There's so much more there in the water that we could be making use of, and the solutions, no pun intended, the solution is there too. And you just described it again.
Well, the irony of it is, let's take it for what it really is. Here's three guys that I've mentioned in the last 15 minutes. You've got Nikola Tesla, you've got Schoberger, and you've got Reich. And all these guys were tuned in pretty much to the same basic concepts, although they have their own particular ways of manifesting it. I mean, Tesla was more into electricity. Schoberger was more into hydrostatic and gravitational forces, and Reich was more into the biological or life forces. But if they're all interrelated, which they probably are, these guys were perceiving things that other people have missed. Okay, fine. Not everybody is that conscious or that so or so inclined to understand things like that in the necessary depth to be able to do something with it. But here's where the crime occurs. They spend their life energies dedicated to understanding this kind of stuff. They reduce it to writing with as much support information as possible so that other people can make use of it. And they publish this material. So Tesla talked about his concepts. Reich wrote many books. I don't even know how many. And Schoberger wrote at least 5 books, possibly more, because some of them haven't been translated yet or perhaps are not known about in our culture. But the point I'm trying to make is, instead of making use of what these guys sacrificed their lives to achieve and understand, our culture ignores all that stuff. The so-called elite go out of their way to suppress all that kind of stuff. And when you do find people that are interested in it, and they go running with a rare copy of a book that explains something amazing to the so-called authorities, which are usually academia, or academiacs, I like to call them, they will immediately be poo-hooed and instructed that things like that just are not possible, they don't exist in the world, and we understand exactly how everything was designed and operates. And that's where it stops. You know, what happened to the idea of saying, well, screw you people, I want to find out for myself? That's what bothers me more than anything. What happened to that pioneering spirit where individuals have a good connection with their internal truth meter and they say, you know what, I don't care what you say, but inside me I feel there's something left to be understood here, which is avoiding understanding by the masses.
Mm-hmm.
But for some strange reason, nowadays the tendency is to put your tail between your legs and walk away and say, gee, I wish that wasn't the case. I really thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, the three gentlemen you mentioned also produced working models on a consistent basis of all of their theories and their writings and their formulas. And see, that's a manifestation. That's a creation of something that challenges the system. It challenges the status quo. Those devices don't require meters, you know, and a meter is a mechanical way of sticking one's hand into another's pocket to take their money. That's all a meter is, you know. So,
yeah, and a lot of times the meters are very deceptive too. I mean, if you study the art of mensuration, especially in the electrical field, you begin to learn that some of the things that they do to produce certain results are in themselves questionable, but nobody questions them because the authorities who design the instruments don't have to answer to anybody. So, you know, I've contemplated a lot of these things over the years, and I've had a reasonably good ability to see through the limitations of certain practices. The problem is that you're up against a well-established and well-entrenched system, and if you don't have money of your own, it's very difficult to build another instrument or a variation of the so-called accepted instruments to see if there is, in fact, something that's either been overlooked or suppressed,
mm-hmm.
even in the application of that information.
Yes,
there's an endless number of things that need to be looked into, and we have to stop taking the word of the so-called authorities when it comes to vital issues. We have to check them out for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. On some past shows, Jim, you and I discussed I don't know if it would be a theory or a hypothesis, or maybe it's a reality, that this force that we call gravity may actually be produced by a pressure being exerted from outside, rather, you know, down upon us, in other words, as to our position on the planet at any given time, and that all we have to do is reverse that process. We discussed that it could very well be these energy grids that are vibrating at a specific frequency, causing us to stay affixed. We're not glued to the ground, but some mammals, for example, have more difficulty moving through those energy fields than others. Some birds are quite adept at just jumping and defying gravity. But they're using other principles. They're riding those energy grids. We're told that they ride the wind. Well, how do they fly when there is no wind? You know, then they're creating the wind, you know, because of the nature of their wings and the resistance and, you know, all these. We go back into the physical all the time and always ignoring the unseen. Yet no one's ever described what gravity looks like. You know, it's an unseen.
Well, it is.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So why don't you do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you brought that up, because let me tell you something, and I read this just the other day. I got a hold of a book that I sent away for, which is really worth reading for people that are interested in all this stuff. It's called Dead Man's Secrets. And essentially it's about the things that were known by races that are long gone from the Earth. But there is enough tantalizing information remaining that the author of this book pieced all these things together, not into a concise science by any means, but into a series of facts which are pretty well indisputable in their own right, because enough information remains that he was able to do this over a period of years. And it certainly suggests that there was a higher form of technology on this planet at one point, long before the era that we call the beginning of modern history or human history or whatever you want to refer to it as. And one of the things that is talked about in some fairly ancient writings regarding this very topic comes to us through the Celts and through the Druids. And I've actually heard of this before I read this book, but there was a whole chapter dedicated to it in this particular volume, and that's why I'm bringing it up. That the Druids had knowledge that survived from an older time, and they used to build what they called stone boats. And these stone boats were exactly that. They were carved out of a huge piece of solid stone, and they were set upon a ley line, and when the operator got onto the stone with so-called magic staff, whatever that may have been, and tapped the stone with it, it levitated, and not only did it levitate, but it scooted off along the various ley lines. And by leaning and using his staff, he could literally switch off onto tributaries of those ley lines and cover enormous distances at very high speeds. And of some of the different people that this capability was rumored, you know, to be understood by, one of them was Merlin. And it's interesting that Stonehenge itself the huge stones, which we know come from quarries very far away from where the actual monument stands, those things were rumored to have been transported by Merlin's engines. And, of course, engines were not defined in terms of what we perceive them to be today, but it clearly designates some form of motive power that's under human control. So there's all these amazing things that suggest that there are other powers which we know nothing about today, but we did know about at one time. And oddly enough, creatures like birds and fish understand them perfectly. We're the dummies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you're saying exactly what my thoughts are, actually. You know, my whole life, I've listened to academia speak about the mythological continent of Atlantis, or the mythological lost continent of Atlantis, and how this was just a folk tale or fiction or an old wives' tale, whatever label you want to put on it. They had to suppress the information. And they do a darn good job of suppressing it on Google Earth, but they're not perfect at it. And in a two-day span, Jim, yesterday I discovered the outline of Lemuria and vast areas that I've determined were populated. And there's every indication that they had very advanced technology. Most likely pyramid and crystal technology. That's something that they didn't quite mask out on the images. And the day before that, I did the same thing in the Atlantic Ocean and came up with enough proof, even a signature written down there by Google themselves. Google Earth had it posted at a certain depth, the words Atlantis Seamount appeared, and not too far
Atlantis
to the
what?
Atlantis Seamount, and a short distance away from there, the words Plato Seamount appeared. Now, on the Pacific side, where I determined Lemuria was, there's one seamount named after Kermit Roosevelt. I found that yesterday. Of course, he was running for his father. Or let's say Teddy Roosevelt put the United States lines in his name. And they named the seamount up near Alaska after Kermit Roosevelt. Now, why name these places if these continents didn't exist? And you should see I call them tire tracks. They've been down there with all kinds of excavation equipment on the bottom of the ocean floor, and you see X's and triangles and square boxes, and you can see these gigantic depressions with very high walls, perfectly rectangular or perfectly circular. And they basically turned every pyramid into a cone. It looks like the Earth had belched a couple of times and spit up some volcanic sputum, and it solidified into a cone. It's so ridiculous what they've done to these images. What would be the harm in us seeing that there were people living here in another time period? Well, they spent a lot of time and a lot of money brainwashing us and indoctrinating us into false or illusory belief systems, not knowledge. The knowledge is that we've been lied to, you see. It took me 2 days, and I did many other things. And I've shown the pictures to a few people, and they're just, you know, you can see their jaw drop. Even though we're talking on the telephone or on the radio show, you can see the awe that they're experiencing when they see these photographs. Huge, huge monuments on the bottom of the ocean floor. Miles down. And one gets the impression...
Well, how is that showing up on the Google stuff? I mean, do they have the ability with these satellites and their imaging system to photograph that deeply?
Oh, yes. They can go even into the Earth, into rock strata and into mineral deposits and what have you. Oh, yeah. They have the ability to do it. But, you know, we're looking at just images. We're not seeing live pictures. And I remarked on Tuesday night's show with Ken Adachi and Zora Nova Star Livingstone, it's funny, all these images they're taking from the satellites, and you don't see one whale. You don't see one shark or one dolphin or one porpoise. You don't even see a guppy. Okay. Well, what would be the reason for that? You see?
Well, I was just going to ask you, what are you implying?
Oh, it's almost like just a mind game on people that they're playing, but they haven't been able to mask the actual photographs to their liking. I'm sure. They've basically airbrushed all the geometric shapes, you know, when you see a pyramid. Now, when I change the lighting of those photographs, which are taken from space, and they're in a medium blue, we'll say. It's not total darkness. In reality, that would be dark, but what's the purpose of taking pictures of the darkness if you can't see what's in it or beyond it? So they lighten the photo up a little bit, and you're getting a representation of the geology on the ocean's floor, the topography. And if you really know what to look for and you have the patience to look and then to zoom into these discoveries, you'll be amazed at what you see. It's amazing. I haven't sent you the photographs, but you'll definitely say, oh, yeah, you found something. That's for sure.
Well, I would love to learn which version of Google Earth you're using and what you're doing with it, because I've tried to use it to go to areas on the planet where I've actually been to already. I know what's there. And it doesn't allow me to go below a certain altitude in the more remote areas. So if the new version of it supersedes that restriction, I would sure love to know about it.
It's not so much the new version as it is having the patience and maybe the discernment to go into the blur, go into the masked out pictures, to go down as far as you can go, okay, and scan the whole entire area and slowly pull out so that you can capture some detail that you didn't see when you were going down. As you're coming back up toward the surface very slowly, and images come into focus at that point, you can find a lot of really interesting things. I mean, there are gigantic statues. There are slabs of rock that have obviously been constructed to serve as some sort of a ritualistic temple, for example. Maybe on a mountaintop or an altar, if you want to use that term. And then next to it is this gigantic pyramid. And it's a different kind of pyramid than the one you're used to seeing. You know, it's not a, let's say, doesn't have the same parameters, specific parameters of some of the pyramids that you see in Egypt where you get the sacred numbers. In making comparative measurements. What you do see, though, is that wherever there is a pyramid, when you lighten the photo or you hit auto level, it adds brightness to the photo, and then you can see the pyramid underneath the cone that they airbrushed. It's a really interesting phenomenon. So now you zoom in on this pyramid, and you say, that's not a cone, that's a pyramid. They tried to make it look like a cone, see? So what are these 100 pyramids doing down there? These are not artifacts, as they would say. you know. Artifacts because of poor technology. Give me a break. Whenever we find something, whenever we discover the truth, they want to tell us the very equipment they gave us to discover it is malfunctioning. You know, like a camera taking a picture of a deuterium laser beam, they're going to say, oh, that's a reflection off the water. That's distortion off the camera lens. Give me a break. Nothing else is distorting like that. Just the deuterium laser. So, you know the story. You've made discoveries, and they deny that they've even seen or witnessed what you're showing them your invention does.
Of course, I always assumed, at least I did it in the early years, you know, that was just a, I don't know what you want to call it, a restriction or the limitation of the mental capacity of the individual that I was, you know, sharing the information with. But, of course, since those early times, I've come to realize that it's a far more complicated issue than that, and it involves our whole educational system, you know, the whole spectrum of human consciousness, and the desires and activities of the overlords. It's not just a question of somebody who's got a PhD and thinks that you're a moron. It's a much more widespread and complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would never have come to those conclusions if I had just accepted the original diagnosis. Oh, you know, I can still remember. I did a paper years and years ago. I was still in college, and it was on the very subject we were just talking about. It was actually on conservative energy versus dissipative energy, and it had to do with different ways of examining the situation and the fact that it gave different results when it's not supposed to give different results. You know, but you're supposed to have a uniform outcome. And there was one professor, I won't mention his name, although I do remember him very clearly, who was NCE at the time that I was there. And I approached this guy with this sizable document. I mean, it wasn't 2 or 3 pages. It was about 15 or 20 pages. It's complete with calculations and diagrams and all that kind of stuff. And he didn't read more than 3 pages, I don't think, when he threw the thing at me and he said, I thought you really understood physics. How can you write this rubbish? You know, and I mean, the thing that astounded me more than anything was the degree of emotion that was expressed over a logical and scientific, what I thought was logical and scientific expose on a very worthwhile subject.
Mm-hmm.
And it just blew me away. I said to myself, my God, you know, this guy's reacting like, you know, like I molested his daughter or something. Never mind presenting him with a paper. You know, it was just unbelievable. But
yeah.
That's the thing that happens. And I think that it has something to do with a threat of some sort that is imposed on someone when you encroach upon the limits of their paradigm. I don't have that problem. I mean, if somebody came to me and said, hey, I can prove to you that everything you're doing is wrong, and here's the right solution, I'd be all over the guy. I'd say, thanks, you know, you're saving me all kinds of time. I'd like to see what the truth is. That's all I'm after anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wouldn't get angry to the point of throwing them out. It's ridiculous.
Yes. Well, it would be like the music professor telling the student, you know, I thought you understood music. Why didn't you write Mary Had a Little Lamb? It's the same principle. Well, Jim, we're about out of time, believe it or not. The time actually flies when we're talking about these things. And I would like to pick up where we left off next week and continue this discussion, because we're getting into some very interesting areas. And we're always going to have that nemesis in the background trying to stop us from becoming the very thing they claim they are. And that's conscious. You know?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting statement.
Well, would you like to make some closing remarks to sum up what we've talked about? And, you know, I know we could probably go on for a couple more hours, but Seth can't.
Easily, I assure you. Well, the thing of it is, I don't know if you've noticed, but tonight I'm pretty upbeat. I have a lot more energy than I have had in a while. And mm-hmm. I think it's primarily because even though the everyday existence is a kind of a grind after a while, even in the field that I'm in, every once in a while you're rewarded with a glimpse of something that you didn't understand previously, or a change in your own conscious perceptions regarding something that you've been studying forever. And all of a sudden, you look at it just a slightly different way, and you see something extraordinary. And that's something that has happened to me just this week regarding a very obscure but very important bit of calculation pertaining to the energy work I've been doing. And so it's interesting that it can affect you emotionally. It really does. It's like you keep pounding away at understanding this stuff, you know, to greater and greater depth, and it seems like you're not getting anywhere. And then if you're persistent enough, then nature tosses you a little tidbit, just enough to encourage you to go further. But those little tidbits feel pretty good after a while, you know?
Mm-hmm. I've been sort of having that experience myself, that you're looking to solve a problem, and you come to a point where you realize that it's all head thinking going on, and so you step away from it and take your mind off of it totally, and suddenly the heart opens up and the realization comes to the mind that the answer was right in front of you. You just
exactly.
didn't use the right approach to access the information.
And the other thing that I've learned from doing this over the years, which is interesting, is when I do reach an impasse, I do exactly what you just said, because I have found that if you continue to concentrate on the issue of your focus, and you do so with unrelenting energy and determination, somehow that action blocks the emergence of what you're really trying to find. But when you do step aside and think about something totally different and just let all that effort that you've invested simmer in some part of your brain, all of a sudden something will open up to you. It feels like it's coming from a different area. So it may very well be, like you said, the heart energy kicking in. But mm-hmm. I know that mechanism is very real, and it works if you do it right.
Well, that's the aspect of the human reality that is mirrored in a sentient flying saucer, that symbiosis that occurs between the pilot and all the passengers in a flying saucer. Are honoring that universal law. They're not fighting it. They're just allowing that to take place naturally. And it's the same process. That process can be transmuted into other areas. You know, it doesn't have to be flying saucers. That's all
sure.
I'm saying.
I understand.
Well, any closing remark you'd like to make, Jim, before we say goodnight?
Well, the only thing I really feel like expanding upon in that regard is to just say that persistence eventually yields rewards.
Yes, and now I hope you don't apply that to the derivatives market. That's been our problem.
No, I don't have anything to do with that stuff. I'm too smart for that.
All right, Jim. Well, I thank you for your input to the show tonight. Very interesting and thought-provoking information. And it even stimulates the heart. So I look forward to your next visit next Friday on Evident Footprints. And I want to wish you a very pleasant and productive weekend, whatever you're doing.
Well, thank you, Don. And I would very much enjoy being back next weekend, and I'm happy to pick up where we left off. So no problem there.
All right. All right. Well, you take care, my friend, and we'll see you next week. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and tonight's guest, scientist, inventor Jim Murray. I want to thank Windtalkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints. Over at BBSRadio.com, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. True Ott. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.